Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's interesting, entertaining, and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Today in the program, we'll talk about cloud computing and one of our fine research institutions in Utah, the University of Utah, who recently received a $10 million grant.
Good morning, Lynn. Beautiful day out there.
Oh, yes, beautiful.
Yeah, and we're fortunate to be able to have this extraordinary view. Well, another scientist from one of Utah's esteemed institutions. We'll speak with Felipe Ramos Lorenzo, who was on a team that discovered an 8,000-year-old mutation that is the key to human life at high altitude. And by high altitude, we're not talking about Park City at 7,000 feet, but even higher.
All that, plus we'll talk about cool science and more big data. About another guest who at the last moment today wasn't able to join us, but his book is so interesting. It's Christian Rutter. He wrote the book Dataclysm. We'll pull some cool science ideas from his book. It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm John Wells. Join Peg Ijams and me Friday at 9 a.m. for the inaugural show of The Morning Mix. Our guests will be Misha Lawson from the Autumn Aloft Balloon Festival and Jenny Maurer with The Walk for Hunger. That's Friday at 9 a.m. on The Morning Mix. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Foothill Oriental Rugs, Utah Olympic Park, Wasatch Brew Pub, Squatters Roadhouse Grill and Pub, and Park Silly Sunday Market.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, Salt Lake City is becoming well-known, or already has been well-known, really, around the world as a center of technology, with data storage facilities, high-tech institutions, even the NSA's data storage facility, in addition to a thriving research facility, the University of Utah. Well, last month, $10 million were granted from the National Science Foundation to build and support a new facility for researchers studying cloud computing. So just what will this new facility endeavor to discover or perfect? Joining us to talk all about it is Robert Ricci from the University of Utah. Robert, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
Well, it's nice to have you, and we'd like to start just with the basics. I think, you know, we hear about the cloud and cloud computing, and of course, cloud paints this picture, the word, of this thing up in the sky, and we know that that's not true, that cloud computing is really sort of borrowing from some big storage facility and access by the web, and that's probably not a great way of putting it, but why don't you explain what it is?
Yeah, sure. Well, so the cloud is, you know, as you said, it's a term that actually means a lot of different things to a lot of people. But the fundamental idea of the cloud is usually leasing or renting space on computers that are you know, owned and operated by somebody else. So individuals might use the cloud. You might use things like Apple's iCloud or Dropbox, where they're basically, you know, selling some storage capacity directly to you, or companies may, you know, use this. So small companies that, you know, can't, you know, for whom it doesn't make sense to run their own server infrastructure may lease servers in the cloud, or even big companies like Netflix or Pinterest, you know, have these spikes in customer demand, and so they use cloud facilities to handle these large demands. And as you said, the cloud is actually, you know, the name paints this very ephemeral picture, but it's actually a very physical thing, right? There are, you know, somewhere you know, a bunch of computers in a data center that are offering up these services, and we pretty much always access them across the web.
Now, it's interesting, and I'm sure you can give us the details of this, that in the Salt Lake Valley, there are a lot of data storage centers. I'm familiar with what was Fusion.io, now it's SanDisk. But is there something, what is it about Salt Lake that would attract these kinds of businesses? The first thing I think about is, you know, maybe the dry climate or something like that, but set me straight.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things, actually. So, you know, the climate makes a big difference. One of the major factors in running a data center is the is cooling it. So, you know, computers generate a lot of heat, and in our environment here, you can do cooling relatively cheaply because during a large part of the year, it's cool enough outside, and you don't actually need additional air conditioning. And you know, even when you do, the dry air is a lot easier to cool. Utah also has fairly cheap power. Because of its location, it's kind of a historic transit hub. A lot of the fiber that runs across the country, a lot of it follows like old railroad lines, for example. And so a lot of it, you can get a lot of connectivity here in Utah.
And Robert, some applications work better in cloud than others. Can you give us an example of the types of applications that really don't work as well in cloud computing?
Yeah, so some applications need real-time guarantees, so they need to be able to process data, kind of as it comes in. And, you know, the cloud is generally, you know, often doesn't provide kind of the guarantees that you might need to be able to process that data in real time, performance guarantees, because it's being shared by a lot of people. Also, there are obviously a lot of security and privacy concerns with the cloud. You know, I believe that there's a lot of concern with storing things like medical data in the cloud because, you know, that's something that is obviously very, very private and sensitive.
Right. And a lot of people think that cloud computing is, a new technology, and certainly the applications are new, and certainly the distributed nature and the size of the computers. But this really goes back to time sharing, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everything old is new again at some point, right? And years ago, we used to talk about, you know, mainframe computers as being, you know, something that, you know, went and sat off in a different room and did your computation for you. And it's not, it's not a fundamentally different thing. I think one of the things that is particularly interesting about cloud computing is that the technologies for sharing a set of computers among a bunch of different users who, you know, all want to kind of have the view that they have the resources to themselves. That technology has gotten really quite good, and that kind of economic model. A lot of the current cloud providers, you know, let you rent computation and storage by the minute or by the hour, which means that, you know, if you have a sudden unexpected demand, you can actually get resources very quickly. And you know, we're building this facility at the University of Utah along with a couple other partners called Cloud Lab. And, you know, the idea behind the Cloud Lab facility is to give researchers access to the resources they need to explore the unique aspects of cloud computing. So the current incarnation of the cloud is relatively new, right? We've only been talking about cloud for, you know, a few years. And so it's not necessarily parts of it are not well understood scientifically. And so, you know, going back to the question of like which applications work well in it and which don't, you know, one of the interesting questions that our facility hopes to help researchers answer is, you know, can some of these applications be made to work well in the cloud?
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, our guest is computer scientist Robert Ricci with the University of Utah, joining us to talk about a $10 million grant from the National Science Foundation that the university recently received. And also, congratulations. I mean, it's a huge deal. You know, we researchers, you know, receiving a $100,000 grant is a big deal, but $10 million for this, it's over 3 years. And is that, It says to, you know, to build and also to support this new facility. Talk about a little bit about when you're starting it. I understand it's downtown somewhere.
Yeah, so it's starting fairly soon. The grant starts on October 1st, and it's going to be at three different locations in the U.S., University of Utah, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Clemson University in South Carolina. The idea behind this is that, you know, real clouds, if you go to rent time on Amazon's EC2 cloud, for example, have this geographic distribution because you want to be close to customers. And the piece that we're building at the U is downtown. The university has a downtown data center that they built just a couple of years ago, and it capitalizes on a bunch of the reasons that we mentioned earlier that, you know, Utah is a great place to build data centers. It uses, you know, cooling from the outside air, and you know, leverages the large amount of fiber that we have available in Salt Lake.
Oh, okay. So when I think of doing research for cloud computing, my mind immediately goes to security. We hear of so many complex security breaches now, and it must be. I mean, to me, it's really scary. I don't know what it feels like to a computer scientist like you.
Well, yeah. So I mean, of course, security is a major class of research that's going to be done on this facility. When you look at, you know, the model that we have for most cloud services today is you give your data to this cloud provider and you trust them to keep it safe. And kind of any protections on the privacy of the data are on the side of the cloud provider. And, you know, by and large, these are trustworthy organizations, but, you know, there are attacks and compromises against them. And so, you know, there is a fair amount of research going on into the idea of, well, how can we build clouds where we put less trust, where we have to put less trust in the cloud provider, right? Where the cloud provider doesn't have access to my data, even if somebody malicious there tried to access it. And other technologies just to make it harder to break into clouds. So those are definitely big focuses of research into cloud technology.
I'm interested, Robert. We had a guest on recently who was talking about different ways that individuals could protect their privacy, and one of the thoughts that this gentleman came up with was an overall password manager, which of course introduces a single point of failure. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I personally use a password manager. I think, you know, one of the big one of the common types of break-ins are, you know, listen, we all have a bunch of passwords, right? And we tend to reuse them between sites.
Right.
And so it may be the case that if you use the same username and password on several different services, if one of those gets broken into, then now, you know, the people who have obtained that might try that same username and password at other services. So it's, you know, one of the good things that you can do for your security is, you know, any you know, website or service that you use that has data that you really care about, right? So that has, you know, your photographs or, you know, to your bank or to your email, you know, use a different password. And then if you use a bunch of services, then, you know, you end up with large number of passwords, and a password manager is a reasonable way of dealing with those. But, you know, you want a password management service where that service, so, you know, many of these store their data in the cloud, you know, some of them are designed such that all of those passwords are encrypted and not even visible to the password manager company, and that's the kind of thing that you want.
Right. Okay. I wanted to ask you about technology. A lot of people run to the opinion that these large data centers, you go in and there's just these massive computers from one vendor, but they're really disparate technologies that are put together with multiple vendors, and certainly that's a challenge to manage, but it's the best way to build a data center. I wanted to ask you, are there any disruptive technologies that are out there that you're keeping your eye on that you're looking forward to hearing more about?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. So one of them that is already kind of making a a significant impact is something called software-defined networking. And that's the idea that, you know, you buy network equipment like switches and routers, and software-defined networking is a set of technologies that allow you to make those more programmable than they have historically been. And it really enables a lot of new ways to share and provide guarantees and provide security in data centers. You know, there are also a bunch of technologies, and you know, we're going to use some of these in our in the piece of cloud lab that we're building here in at the University of Utah that look at lower power, because power is a big issue in data centers. It, you know, it costs a lot of a lot of money to get the power to run these machines, and there are various different technologies such as different processor architectures, et cetera. And we are our team at the University of Utah is working with HP on some to get early access to some of the new low power systems that they're building.
Right, and on Cool Science Radio, we try to tell our listeners what we're talking about. You know, acronyms and new terms and things like that. So let me just quickly say that a disruptive technology comes along every once in a while. It is not a better mousetrap. It's like looking at the mouse completely different and looking at the trap completely different. I mean, it's a whole new way to do something, and when a disruptive technology comes along, things usually really push forward.
And our hope in building this facility is to, you know, let the research community have access to the infrastructure they need to develop that kind of thing in cloud architectures. So a lot of the technologies that have gone into a modern cloud, like some of the server virtualization technologies, a lot of those actually were started out as academic projects. And then, you know, when the value of them became apparent, actually got incorporated into clouds. But now we're in the situation where to make further progress, we as researchers need access to facilities that are large enough scale and have the right kind of technologies to be able to really try out ideas and convince our other researchers and industry that that these are things that can really change the way that we build and use cloud.
Okay. You know, I'm wondering, Robert, about the National Science Foundation and granting these monies to academic research institutions, and wondering about, what their main goals are and why the money is being poured into, you know, what can research institutions or academic institutions do that, technology can't or corporations cannot right now?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. So to use an analogy, if you want to study architecture and construction of buildings and et cetera, you can't go rent an apartment and sit in the apartment and study, and learn from sitting in the apartment how architecture works. So, mm-hmm. And when you go to a commercial cloud provider, that's what you're doing. You're a tenant, they give you your own little piece of the cloud. But if you really want to be able to fundamentally understand how these things work and how they can be constructed and how they, can be modified and et cetera, then what you really need is the ability, is the set of tools and pieces to, build buildings of your own and look at, how the plumbing systems work and look at how the electrical systems work and that kind of thing. So this cloud lab facility that we're building is really, it's not just another cloud. It isn't a cloud itself. It is a place for researchers to come build their own clouds and essentially operate as their own little miniature cloud provider, so that they can see, they get complete transparency. It's a scientific instrument with high standards for scientific fidelity, and they can see all the moving parts that they wouldn't, and control those parts that they wouldn't necessarily be able to see and control if they were renting time on somebody else's cloud.
Huh. Very interesting. So what is your role in this, and what is your role at the University of Utah?
Yeah, so I'm a research professor in the School of Computing at the University of Utah. I am the PI and the lead on this grant. My group, the Flux Research Group, has been building infrastructure for network and systems experimenters for actually about 15 years. We build infrastructure where researchers come to us and they sort of describe a network that they want to run some kind of experiment on, and we built the software and the hardware infrastructure that automatically builds that network for them in a matter of minutes. And we have about somewhere on the order of I think about 5,000 users worldwide who use the facilities that we run at the University of Utah. They've run hundreds of thousands of experiments and published, thousands of papers based on that research.
I wanted to ask you about bottlenecks. Technology typically gets pushed forward when there's a bottleneck everyone's trying to solve. What are the current bottlenecks when you look at networks and raw computation and sharing of data and those sorts of things?
Well, I think that the three biggest bottlenecks that I would identify are in the cloud space is how you share the computation efficiently in ways that gives everybody some level of guaranteed service without imposing large overheads. I think another and a lot of that, that computation requires a lot of power, and so power is an important piece of that calculation. Another is on the network side. So in a traditional cloud, the cloud provider, for example, typically doesn't tell you much about the network that you're running on. And so it can be hard to, optimize your application for the particular network you're on. It can be hard to get particular guarantees and properties like, getting very low latency or very high bandwidth on that network. And that's one of the kinds of things that, will make Cloud Lab different is that we actually expose the entire network to the user. And then I think a third one is that's a pretty big deal is high speed access to storage. Many services run in the cloud because they want access to large amounts of data, be that databases or giant collections of photographs or collections of scientific data. But it's hard to get consistent, predictable performance when you're sharing that storage system with thousands or even tens of thousands of other users. And so some of the work that my group and others are doing looks at how to make access to that storage more predictable.
And are they dedicating blades and things like that to be able to ensure performance?
Well, so it depends on the cloud. So many clouds offer you virtual machines, which are, taking, the actual processors and memory and network cards in one computer and splitting them among a bunch of users, and, ways to make that both efficient and really give performance isolation to those users. That's one important area of research. Other clouds are willing to give you a computer all of your own to get isolation. The catch is that tends to erode some of the economic incentive to use the cloud, because part of the reason you can get resources cheaper in the cloud is leveraging these economies of scale and taking one piece of equipment and dividing it up a bunch of other users. So there are a bunch of trade-offs there, and it's definitely an active area of research.
Mm. Robert, before we let you go, I have to ask you, $10 million is great. You must be giddy about that. But it really doesn't stand up to the $1.5 billion the government spent to build that Utah data center out between Utah Lake and Salt Lake. And I understand it was completed last year. And, there's not a lot we know about it. What does someone like you know about it that you can tell us without having to then kill us?
Well, the facility, kind of the design of the facility itself, like the physical buildings, et cetera, is not really secret. What they do inside of it, of course, is secret. And You know, I don't really know, you know, there's not really anything I can tell you about what they do inside of it, because I don't know, right? But, you know, you can imagine that there's probably lots of, you know, that there's that they probably have lots of, you know, very smart people working on very complicated algorithms to sort through massive amounts of data. You know, kind of beyond that, I think, you know, anything that we can say about what specifically they're doing is kind of a guess.
Yeah, interesting. I read somewhere that Edward Snowden said that it was initially known as the Massive Data Repository, but that was kind of a scary name, and they ended up renaming it to the Mission Data Repository, but also known as the Intelligence Community Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative Data Center. That's simple.
Like their long names and their acronyms.
A black SUV just pulled up in front of the station. Lynn, I think someone's looking for you.
That's right. I mean, it is very interesting, huge facility and visible, but we don't know. And by design, the NSA doesn't want us to know what goes on there.
Right.
Robert, if you could wave a magic wand and solve one big technical hurdle in the work in front of you, what would that be?
Well, I think if I just look at at cloud computing in general, I think the biggest thing that I would want to solve is the privacy concerns that we have.
Absolutely.
And we would really like to have ways that we can use these cloud providers as a way of storing our photos and our documents and our, you know, and our records of a sensitive nature, and, you know, without having to worry about, you know, what if somebody breaks into the cloud provider, right? What if somebody, an insider at that cloud provider, you know, is motivated to try to steal that information? I think that would be the biggest one, because I think that's one of the things that makes a lot of people a little bit nervous, and rightly so. I think a reasonable rule of thumb when you think about, you know, is this something that I'm willing to put in the cloud, is, you know, the cloud is somebody else's computer, and there are advantages and disadvantages to using somebody else's computer, right? The advantages mm-hmm. being that they're, you know, doing the work of maintaining it and making sure it stays up and backing it up and keeping it up all the time. You know, and the disadvantages being that that you're potentially giving them access to your data. So that's a trade-off that we have to make every time we decide if we want to use the cloud. And it's one that, you know, if we had better technological solutions to that privacy problem, would make the cloud even more attractive.
Good answer. Before I let you go, Salt Lake City is known as, in the top five or so for being able to find a job in technology in the country, you know, after places like Seattle and Baltimore and Raleigh. And how much is the University of Utah Computer Science Program, your graduates feeding into great jobs around?
Yeah, of course. You know, we put out a lot of really high quality graduates, and, you know, employers here and elsewhere, you know that, and I think that's we put out a lot of graduates in a lot of different areas. We actually, the University of Utah is working on a data center engineering certificate. So, for example, people will be able to graduate from here with a certificate in, you know, building data centers, and that will make, you know, that will just add to the number of reasons why this is a good place to put a data center.
Very good. All right, Robert Ricci, the University of Utah, and the new $10 million grant from the National Science Foundation. We appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a really pleasure.
All right, take care. Again, Robert Ricci, computer scientist with the University of Utah. Stay with us. It's Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be back to talk about, a few cool science stories, and then talk about a gene mutation that allows people to live at, 13,000 feet. You too, John Wells, can go live in the Tibetan Plateau. If you want, we'll see if you have that particular mutation. I don't know. Maybe you're better off at 7,000 feet.
I'm going to box up my Air Force drone, my drone Air Force, and take them to Tibet.
I think they've been recently disallowed there as well as our national parks.
Yeah, they're quiet, though.
Oh, Okay. Yeah. All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Nexus IT is proud to have supported KPCW for the past 10 years. Nexus IT provides on-premise and cloud voice over IP, phone systems, and service that simplify and unify your business telecommunications. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's entertaining and accessible. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, this morning we were also due to talk with a really interesting person. He's a Harvard-trained mathematician who was one of the founders of OkCupid. His name is Christian Rutter, and he's written a new book called Dataclysm, already a pretty popular, well-selling book. So well-selling, in fact, that someone bigger, I guess, nabbed him for this morning's interview, and we're going to talk to him next week. But in the meantime, we thought it was so interesting, some of the things. So it's a conversation, really, John, about big data and not data storage, like right. We just talked about with Robert Ricci, but sort of statistics, what big data tells us about us. And of course, no better place to learn that from than a dating website. I had never heard of OkCupid, but apparently it's one of the premier dating sites around. And this mathematician just sits around all day compressing and compiling data and finding out some interesting things about us.
Yeah, so as a result of amassing all of this information, this data, they are able to compare what somebody says that they want, compare that to their actual behavior. And he's gone through all of this and looked at a lot of data and come up with some interesting things.
Yeah, it's interesting that we think we know what we want. And I've heard this before about websites, dating websites, rather. When you put up your profile, what you say you want isn't really what you end up wanting. And they can tell, and he can tell, through amassing this data, that we actually have lots of interesting things that we don't know we have, like a lot of racial bias. That was one of the things. That men, I don't know why this one popped up. Do you want to talk about it? What men say they want, but then what they clearly want.
Are you talking about age or something?
Yeah. I'm trying to lead in to get you to say it.
Oh, get me to say it. So I guess they looked at a lot of information and they found that a 40-year-old woman would certainly very much like to meet a 40-year-old guy. And the actual behavior was that that's what they wanted to do. And guys, as it turns out, the 40-year-old guys, many of them were looking for 20-year-old girls. But they might have been too shy or too embarrassed to approach those people, so they ended up with 35 or 30-year-old women. I really don't know. But I feel like you're looking at me.
I'm looking at you in this accusative way.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Okay. All right.
Not at all. Okay, we'll leave that one behind.
Yeah.
Another thing that he talks about in his book, it's not just about dating websites, because that would be far too simple for Christian Rutter. He talks about things like how our language is evolving. And he says he looks at the fact that divisive speech is increasing. And, it increases to that. It's not surprising that we're becoming more polarized. And there is more and more divisive speech out there. So I found that very interesting. Another thing you found out.
But specifically about the Twitter feeds that they looked at, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something heartening. I learned last week as I was forced to send tweets from the Third District Court in the hearing out there on the ski resort litigation. I loved it, first of all. I've been very...
concise.
Well, it forced me to be concise, but I've been very hesitant to get into the whole Twitterverse and haven't wanted to, but I did this day. And it was so surprising to me at literally how concise it made me be with my, you know, with 140 characters. I really enjoyed it. And what he's found is that tweeting, for example, does not degrade our language. In fact, we're using longer words than were used in some of the Shakespearean works.
And that's hard to believe, but you know, so they have to limit it to 140 characters, and they use certain abbreviations like the letter U for YOU, but they're using larger words in their communication in the message and in the rest of the message. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, and yeah. I find it hard to believe because we do when we're tweeting try to be so concise and use as few characters as possible. But I don't know, maybe out of that somehow. We want to use five-syllable words.
Yeah, one of the things that was in his book that you touched on earlier was that people will state something and their behavior will be different. For an example, they might be saying, "I'm looking for that special person, and race does not matter." However, in their actual behavior, we are racist. I mean, they said, for an example, that certain races do not get contacted after they contact someone else, and there's, you know, so it's a little tougher out there.
Yeah, very interesting. We'll look forward to a conversation with him for maybe next week. And in the meantime, let's hear from our underwriters, and we'll be back with the one of the researchers on the team that discovered this gene mutation that
Before
allows.
We do, could ahead. I ask you a quick, or just make a comment and get your thought on it? And that's. A few friends of mine that are in the Match world, Match.com, told me that the two things that people lie about the most, that men lie about their height and women lie about their age, and they both lie about the age of their pictures when they send pictures.
I don't know, but I would be willing to believe it. And I've got Leslie Thatcher here, our news director, and I think she stepped in to say maybe we've got some breaking news.
We do, yeah. So just got this in the email that Powder, of course, the owner of Park City Mountain Resort, just sent out an email saying that they have sold the base area, the parking lots, the ski train, the chairlifts, the water, the snowmaking to Vail Resorts, and they say that's effective immediately.
My goodness.
Just like that. Anyway, I just want to read the prepared statement that John Cumming had sent along. He said that while selling was the last thing he wanted to do, he said that he believes the law around the issue should be changed, but the ongoing legal battle wasn't in line with his company's core values. And the sale was really the only way to provide that long-term certainty for the Mountain Resort employees and the community. Interesting, as part of the sale, the agreement with Vail Resorts is that Vail must retain the Mountain Resort employees in their current roles. So
that
means
that.
Jenny Smith staying on, as well as, you know, all of the, you know, higher ups. So we'll see how long that lasts.
Wow. So
was there a price mentioned?
Oh no.
I thought I'd ask anyway.
Oh no. It's again, Powder Corp announcing that they have sold the base area, all of the parking lots, everything that Vail needs to run the resort, and that is effective immediately. So it looks like it's a turnkey operation. The employees will be staying in place. They know how to run the resort. They've been doing it, you know, since 1994, and it's a done deal.
Wow. So what this means, first of all, is the $17.5 million bond will not be posted on Friday, as we were told earlier this week, because now the whole schlemiel has been sold to Vail Resorts. And also what this means, I would assume, is that all the permitting that has been in place for Park City Mountain Resort and Powder Court will just be transferred over, as you said, a turnkey operation.
Yeah. So they'll receive the vested rights there for the development that they have in the lower parking lots. And whether or not they move forward with Woodward remains to be seen. But I know that PCMR, or Powder, still is the owner of the Woodward Camp. So whether or not that's something that John wants to develop on his own, I guess, remains to be seen.
Right. So that was not mentioned in the press release at all. Undoubtedly, though, that's part of the sale agreement, the purchase agreement, in some way, bringing Woodward into it. The plans are all in place for it.
Yeah. And while we knew, that mediation was ongoing with this, you just see the magnitude of all of the I's that have to be dotted and the T's that have to be crossed in terms of this. So whether or not that has all been done, or whether or not they just wanted to move forward with a purchase, that they had agreed to sell and that purchase price had been reached at, and there may be lots of details to come out in the coming days. But it was interesting, though, we had an interview scheduled with Jenny Smith from Park City Mountain Resort this morning just to talk about what's next, and that was canceled really late yesterday afternoon, perhaps knowing that something like this was going to come out on this. So
big
we hope to talk to her as soon as she's
now, this
available.
Is speculative, but I'd like to throw it out for everybody's comment, and that is, what do you think about the canyons and what used to be PCMR acting autonomously versus connecting the two?
Well, that's what's interesting, because that event, that's where they were before the lease, it kind of dawned on them that the lease had expired.
Right.
They were in negotiations about connecting the resort. So absolutely.
Yeah.
Eventually. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. But and it'll be also interesting to say, does Park City Mountain Resort, do the new owners have that name? Or do they have to change it back to Park City Ski Area, or does it become, Vail Park City, or, who knows?
That will be one of the first big questions that the community will want to know. There's something that we feel like there's a lot of kinship. It's Park City. It's the name of the town. The community will want the resort to maintain or to retain that name in some way, but we'll see. No doubt we'll have more breaking news about this development at during the noon news report at 12:06, and that was KPCW's news director Leslie Thatcher coming in, delivering that breaking news that Vail has now purchased the base area and everything that goes along with operating a turnkey resort. Big stuff. We're going to take just a quick underwriting break, and we'll be back with our second guest that is joining us to talk about the 8,000-year-old mutation key to human life at high altitudes. It's Felipe Ramos Lorenzo of the University of Utah, who's been patiently waiting on hold for while we break that news. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak, my co-host. We just spoke with Robert Ricci from the University of Utah about cloud computing. And now we welcome another local scientist, Felipe Ramos Lorenzo from the University of Utah's Center for Clinical and Transitional Science. He was on a team that recently discovered a gene mutation that provides some of the keys to human life that is at 15,000 feet. Think Nepal or Tibet. It's a genetic variation or mutation that contributes to the adaptation that allows people to thrive at higher altitudes. And maybe he'll even provide some clues as to how we can better thrive at 7 or 8,000 feet here in Park City. Felipe Ramos Lorenzo, welcome to Cool Science Radio. We are having some difficulties. We're going to try to work those through.
Oops.
Need to push a button? Okay. Felipe, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good morning. Apologize. We're having some challenges this morning, but
I can hear you very well.
Okay, great. Thank you. How do you isolate a mutating gene?
how do we isolate a mutating gene? Well, this actually started when we previously studied the Tibetan high-altitude population. We go over their DNA and look for a gene by segregating and comparing them with lowlander. So we came up with 10 genes that are of highly selected for the Tibetan that you cannot find lowland. So we assume that these 10 genes are a candidate for them adopting in high altitude. And we screened them individually, and we found one gene specifically that works for oxygen. It reacts with oxygen, and we found a mutation in that gene and study it further. That leads into this discovery.
So, for an example, would that have something to do with Sherpas that can take people up to the top of Everest without oxygen?
Yes. Actually, what we did, we compare the population up in the high altitude, and we compare them with the lowlander and compare the gene. So the top gene, we screened for a variant, and we found that this gene, exposing those lowlanders to a high altitude, could cause some effect in their health, like lung problem, pulmonary edema, brain edema, which usually encountered by people going into a high altitude.
So does this mutation then, Felipe, allow someone to just adapt to the amount of oxygen or actually need less oxygen?
This mutation, we found out, actually is beneficial for those who are in low oxygen. So if you live in high altitude, you do not develop increase in red cell. Normally, when a person go high up in the mountain, there is less oxygen, so their body produces more red cells. We call it polycythemia, the increased red cell, to provide more oxygen in your body required. That's why we have difficulty in breathing. And for these highlanders, most of them, not all, but most of them were adopted. Their hemoglobin don't go up. So this is the key point. This is the feature for them, that they do not develop high red cells. Having high red cells later on chronically could cause medical conditions.
Right. So even when we have people come from sea level to Park City for a ski vacation, for example, some people adapt better than others. Some people come up and they feel fine and they start skiing. Others need to take a full day to, so that they don't feel nauseous and have a headache. And you know, some people are really debilitated by it. So does that mean that for those people, their red blood cells have increased more than others?
Yes, this is their body's reaction to the environment with the low oxygen. So there are some people who react very badly with low oxygen, and there are some who adapted. And these are what we called SNP variant. The gene has some variation that makes them adapt well. There are also many studies, some other gene actually involved. And the one that we found are mostly attributed to a higher altitude, above 15,000 feet, 4,000 meters and above. And there are some also at the mid-level. So it's not only one gene actually. And the one that we found are specific for the Tibetan.
Huh. Very interesting. So there must be some point or some elevation in which there's sort of diminishing returns, that no matter how adaptable you are and how mutated your gene is, that...
I would believe so. That is,
Right. And so talk a little bit, if you would, about the distribution of people across the planet that live above 11,000 feet or 13,000 feet or even, I mean, does anyone live above 15,000 feet?
The one that we're studying right now, there are three populations we're targeting. One is the Tibetan, the other is the Andean, South America, and the people living in the high altitude of Kilimanjaro in Africa. So these three populations live actually in a high altitude. And many research groups have been studying them, and right now we're actually doing the Bolivians, the Aymaras.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and we would like to compare, and we believe that they have a different mode of adaptation with the Tibetan. There have been studies before that the Aymarans have when they compare it with the Tibetans, they said, have a bigger lung capacity and more vasculature when they study the physiology of this individual, which is very interesting. So probably environment, location, geographical location might have played a role in the different genes for them to adopt.
That's very interesting that it wouldn't just be the same type of adaptation.
Yes, yes. At first I thought it would be, but yeah. Not.
Right. And so this provides people like you with a lot further research to do. I mean, that you've just kind of uncovered one key.
Yeah, that's very true. So it's been like a wildfire, actually. There are many calls like from Bolivia who wants to have an expedition and do some studies. We just really open a door to high-altitude medicine, actually, to do further research.
In the world of evolution, how long would this type of mutation take?
Oh, it will take thousands of years, actually. The 8,000, we computed that by algorithm based on the generation per family mating over generations. So the University of Utah Division of Genetics had this software they developed wherein they can age the changes. So you compare this with the population globally to determine how old that is. So that 8,000 actually is an estimate. And the distribution of the difference of the... If you have seen, there have been news that they discovered that the Tibetan has a gene that they associate with the Denisovan. If you're aware of the Denisovan, those are old, like Neanderthals, who separate with the evolution of human, that they say that must have been admixed with the Homo sapien. That's why this Tibetan, actually, we found that there is a Denisovan gene within them, while the non-Tibetan has less than 1%, and the Tibetan has more than 5 or 10% of that.
Oh, that's...
So maybe those Denisovan gene has an advantage in high altitude, which is now in active research.
Wow, so much more research to unfold for you. It's really fascinating. Felipe Ramos Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us. Lorenzo is a researcher at the University of Utah. And, you know, we cheated you out of time a little bit because of this breaking news today,
okay.
Felipe. But
okay.
We'd like to have you back on, and we feel like you're going to have a lot of research ahead of you.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, that was Felipe Ramos Lorenzo of the University of Utah. And just want to recap the breaking news director of KPCW, Leslie Thatcher, was just in making the announcement. We received moments ago, really, a press release from Powder Core and Park City Mountain Resort saying that there has been a sale of the entire base area, including snowmaking and water and really
parking.
Parking and everything that would make it possible for Vail Resorts, the purchaser of the property, to come in and have a turnkey operation. The resort will be open this coming season, and Park City Mountain Resort obviously now will not be posting that bond that we've been reporting on all week. So big news.
Fascinating, and there's going to be a lot more to come, I mean, as far as getting more details about this.
That's right. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We'll go to some music for a couple of hours, and then the KPCW Noon Report at 12:05.
Yes, stay tuned to KPCW as we will be getting more information on this. As we get information, we will let you know.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We want to thank our underwriters today, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. Also our guests today, Robert Ricci and Felipe Ramos Lorenzo, both from the University of Utah.